Classical music may not be as popular as it once was, yet chances are that everybody still knows what a Stradivari is, one of a thousand stringed instruments that the master craftsman Antonio Stradivari made during the late 1600s and early 1700s. Approximately 600 of these treasured instruments survive. Toby Faber writes about six of them in his book Stradivari's Genius, five violins, one cello, and three centuries of enduring perfection.
I began my story, well, with the Messiah violin, really. I mean, most of these violins are named after famous previous owners. That's not the case, obviously, for the Messiah violin, which was not owned by the Messiah. Rather, it is famous, and it's still the most famous violin in the world, really, because it is perfectly preserved. Its varnish in particular still looks exactly as it did when it first came out from Stradivari's workshop. And even in the middle of the 19th century, that made it unique. And when an Italian violin dealer came to Paris to boast that he had this amazing, perfectly preserved Stradivari back home in Milan, nobody believed him, but he carried on boasting, and they got more and more exasperated with him, until eventually one person said to him, "This violin of yours, it is like the Messiah, always expected and never appears." So that's how it got its name. Well, anyway, it did eventually appear, and that the story of its appearance really made it the most famous violin in the world.
One of the stories associated with it is that no owner has ever been able to give it up during his or her lifetime. It's not quite true, but it's an indication of the way in which this instrument has grabbed hold of people's attention, isn't it?
I think that's right, and I think people who really care about violin making just love to look at this violin. In fact, I think it's not as beautiful as many other Stradivarius, because part of what makes a violin beautiful is the way the varnish has aged on the back of the violin. And it doesn't have that. But people who know about making violins just go into raptures about it. On the other hand, I think anybody who plays a violin, and this is one violin that's hardly ever been played, but performers develop that kind of link with all their violins, I think. It's such a partnership that they can't bear to part with the instrument.
Now, how is it that this one is so perfectly preserved?
I think it's happenstance, really. If you look at the sort of first 100 years of its life, it seems to have been inherited by one of Stradivari's sons, who inherited a number of instruments. It's just this was one of the last ones that he then sold on. He sold on to a nobleman who was a collector rather than a player. And then that collector passed it on to another collector. And then by the time we reached the middle of the 19th century, that made it pretty much unique, but never having been played. And from then on, nobody was going to play it, because it was the last example left of an unused Strad.
One of the other things that is consistent throughout all of the stories you've told is that the players talk about the communication with the instrument, how they feel as though the music that has been performed on it by previous performers is there for them to draw out. That would almost argue that the Messiah is less valuable because there is so little music being added to it over the years, if you believe their theory.
It's certainly true, I think, that a violin won't sound good until it's been played for a while. And players do talk about detecting when they play a violin or a cello, the previous player. They can somehow detect their tone and their sound in the violin as they play it, which is understandable, I suppose, because to a certain extent, violins do contribute to the sound of a player. As for whether or not they store these memories of previous performances, well, it would be nice to believe that was true.
Well, especially when you consider that some of these instruments have been played and owned by some of the great violinists of history. Menuhin, for instance, owned the Kevenhuller, one of the Strads that you write about.
Yes, and what I love about that violin, although certainly Menuhin was a very spiritual violinist, of course, and he certainly was conscious, as he played the Kevenhuller, of the spirits that were in it from previous players. One of those previous players, for example, was the man who led the first successful performances of Beethoven's late quartets in the 1820s. I love the idea of this violin, which Menuhin played before the Second World War, really at his peak, also being played 100 years before in some of the most important performances, really, on any violin.
How well are these instruments documented? Are you able, for instance, to be able to track the development of his skill through the course of his years? Did the violins get better and better as he went along?
You can certainly do that, yes. Really, he was born around 1644, and his first violins he started to make around in the mid-1660s. And they're very well carved, but not particularly good in terms of their, as violins, well, I mean, they're still pretty good, better than anything being made today, but still, they're not necessarily his best violins by any stretch of the imagination. You can see him getting better throughout, all the way through to the 1680s, and then the 1690s, really experimenting with the form of the violin, trying to get this greater tone that he wanted from his instruments. And he ended up succeeding around 1700. And from 1700 to 1720 is what we call his golden period, when he produced the famous violins that are the most valued today and are the ones that people still try to copy today, really.
What kind of changes did he make in his instruments in order
to... He experimented a lot with the shape of the violin when you see it face on, in terms of making it longer and narrower. And those violins from the 1690s are called the long strads. In fact, that didn't really succeed, but at the same time, he was experimenting with the shape of the violin viewed side on. A Stradivarius, by comparison with what went before, is much flatter viewed side on than the relatively bulbous violins that went before. And that basically delivers more in terms of amplification area in the sound box of the violin. And that's what gives the violins the greater power. Although Stradivari was making them at a time when people didn't really need it. By the 19th century, when people were playing in large concert halls, they found they really needed that greater power in their violins. And then, as I say, he lived a long time. His violins for the last 15 years of his life are still very good, but they are his hand is starting to get a bit shakier, so you can see the sound holes are carved slightly less neatly and that sort of thing.
One of the instruments that you write about is not a violin, but a cello, and it is not necessarily a logical step for him to make. Yes, they're both stringed instruments, and yes, they are played often together, but there's a big difference in size and in what you're trying to accomplish between making a violin and making a cello. Did he bring the same skill to the cello that he brought to the smaller instrument?
He did. It's very interesting, actually, because you can see the early cellos of Stradivari and also everybody went before him are much larger than modern cellos. And he obviously started to worry about this in the same way as he was worrying about the tone of violins. And for a few years, once he perfected the form of the violin, he didn't make any cellos at all. Then he went back to making cellos and produced basically the form that we now know of as the modern cello. And his cellos are every bit as valuable and sought after as his violins, if not more so, because they're rarer. Making a cello takes a lot more effort than making a violin. And he made many, many fewer.
One of those instruments is the one you write about, the Davidoff, and it is associated with two of the great cellists of the 20th century, Jacqueline Dupré and Yo-Yo Ma. The curious thing, in a way, is that while you extol the virtues of this instrument, neither Dupré nor Ma seems to have found it an instrument to be favored.
That is the curious thing, I agree. I think in Jacqueline Dupré's case, she did produce some of her greatest music, some of her greatest recordings, playing the instrument. She never seemed entirely comfortable with it, and people now think perhaps she would have been better with a Montagnana, who Domenico Montagnana made cellos in Venice a little bit after Stradivari, because she was such an emotional, emphatic player. She liked to feel that the more you put into an instrument, the more you get out. Stradivari's, you have to play, you have to draw the sound out, really, in a slightly more subtle way. I think Yo-Yo Ma loves the Davidoff, but he also has a Montagnana, which he also loves too. The Davidoff is set up now. He set it up for Baroque playing. So when he plays Baroque music, he plays it on the Davidoff.
There does seem to be an emotional attachment to the Davidoff for Yo-Yo Ma, because, in fact, he borrowed it from Dupré, didn't he?
He did. I mean, obviously, for the last 15 years of her life, Dupré wasn't really able to play her cello with her multiple sclerosis, and for a long time it sat unused in a storeroom or a Parisian violin dealer until Yo-Yo Ma was allowed first to try it and then to borrow it. And he's described the process as like opening up a really great wine. The sound just kept on coming and coming.
He talks about coaxing the sound out of that instrument.
That's right, and that comes back to what I was saying about that's the way you need to treat strads, really. You need to treat them more gently than some of the other. Treat them right, and they'll treat you right, I think is the phrase.
Why is it, do you think, that no one has been able to make an instrument to match the Stradivari. Certainly there have been artists, there have been musicians, there have been scientists who have devoted much attention to it. Is there really such a difference? I mean, does it come down to art and magic?
You can't totally discount art and magic, I think, but I'm a rationalist at heart, and I search hard for rational explanations. The point is that we need to come back to, I think, is that violins and cellos do need this period of aging before they really reach their full potential. It's not the full 200 or 300 years, but it's 50 or 100 years. And if we look back at the violins that were being made 50 or 100 years ago, like Vuillaume's, for example, we can see the mistakes that he was making, if you like. Modern violin makers certainly aren't making those mistakes. They may be making other ones. But I do think it's quite conceivable that the violins that are being made today will, after 50 or 100 years, sound as good as Strauss. I might even go further and say that modern violin makers have a whole set of other advantages that Stradivarius never had in terms of the knowledge of the physics of the violins, acoustics, material science. And I'm sure the best of them is not, they're not just trying to copy Stradivarius. They're trying to use modern technology as well to help them. I'd like to think that in 50 or 100 years, it won't be the case, as it still is at the moment, that when a soloist steps on a stage, more often than not, they'll be playing Stradivarius.
It does make you realize, though, that if it takes 50 to 100 years for an instrument to achieve its potential, Stradivari never knew that his own were as good as they are.
You're absolutely right. I mean, so much has changed in the world of violin playing since he was making instruments, not just their aging, but the bow has changed, the tension the strings are under has changed, the type of strings has changed. It's entirely clear to me that whatever he heard, it's very different from what we hear now. And it just shows what good anticipation he had of our current needs when he was making these violins so many years ago.
Toby Faber is the author of Stradivari's Genius, 5 violins, 1 cello, and 3 centuries of enduring perfection.